KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
We are from Hayward.
We're from the Inner Sunset.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
I live in Sausalito.
Coming up, why most solo drivers of electric cars are getting kicked out of the carpool lane.
Now that electric cars have gotten cheaper, the state might decide finally that people don't need the carpool lane incentive to buy electric cars.
We'll revisit the balancing point of sustainability and traffic. Then a one-woman show takes us into the home of a New York family as they prepare for Hurricane Sandy.
If it gets to be too bad, the East River can flood that part of the area, and that's what happened.
Plus, the backstory behind a seasonal San Francisco show.
Ebenezer Scrooge has come home from his counting house.
Bah humbug. Cross Currents is coming up. On January 1st, there will be new rules in California about who can use the carpool lane and who can't. Over 200,000 drivers of electric and plug-in vehicles will no longer be able to take the fast lane. KLW's transportation reporter Eli Wertschafter is here with me to explain how the rules are changing and why. Hi, Eli.
Hi, Hannah.
Okay, can we start off with this? First of all,
okay.
I have a friend who bought an electric vehicle.
Yeah.
A few years ago to get, you know, like that faster commute. Now he sold it because he says, you know, he won't be able to use the carpool lane anymore. So I'm wondering, you know, what's going on? Who still gets to drive in the carpool lane after January 1st?
There are over 300,000 electric cars in California that have special stickers that in the past have allowed you to drive in the carpool lane.
Mm-hmm.
And those stickers come in three colors. There's the old kind in green and white, and now there's new ones in red. Those ones started coming out in March of this year, red. Everyone wants the red one now because the green and the white ones are going out of style.
Uh-huh.
Starting January 1st, if you've got a green or a white sticker on your car, can't use it anymore,
mm-hmm.
you got to get a red one.
Okay, so then I just go to the DMV and get me a red sticker.
It is a little bit harder than that. The problem is you're only allowed to upgrade your green or white sticker to a red one if you applied for your sticker in the last 2 years, in 2017 or 2018.
Okay.
So people with older stickers are going to lose the ability to drive in the carpool lane. And that applies to almost two-thirds of everyone who has stickers right now.
Okay. So I have a sticker that's more than 2 years old. I cannot renew it.
Okay, actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that still because there's some new rules that depend on what income level you have.
Mm-hmm.
Higher income people might not be eligible anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So for anyone listening who has a electric vehicle, best thing to do is look it up on the DMV website. We'll have a link to that. There's also a new rule that says that lower income people who buy a used electric car with a sticker that otherwise would expire could get to renew that sticker, could get to turn it red. So
mm-hmm.
it's possible that Your friend sold his car.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that he sold it to someone who will be able to use the carpool lane that he's
because
shut
of
out
their
of
income
now.
Level.
Because of their income level and his income level.
Okay, let's get to this shiny new red sticker. Do the cars have to be any more efficient than they were to get a green or white one?
No, it's actually the same standard. It just has to be a new car, or it could be an older car that only got its sticker within the last 2 years. The efficiency standards haven't changed, but the old stickers are phasing out.
Okay, so, I mean, if the stickers don't actually encourage more efficient cars, what's the whole point?
The point is to lower the number of cars using the carpool lane.
Uh-huh.
So you don't have an electric car, but maybe you've been in the carpool lane with your kids.
Yes,
and
I have.
Have you ever done that and felt like it's actually going slower than all the other lanes?
All the time.
Okay, so there you go. So it may not be all the time slower than the other lanes, but that's the problem. Our carpool lanes in California are getting really full.
Mm.
When this sticker program started, it was a way to get people to buy more efficient cars.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it worked. In the past few years, the electric car market has exploded, especially in California, which has this incentive and other incentives for electric car drivers.
Mm.
And now carpool lanes in the Bay Area are very crowded.
Because everybody and their mama bought an efficient car.
Exactly.
Mm.
About 60% of carpool lanes in the Bay Area are what the government calls degraded, meaning they're not moving fast enough to meet the federal standard of a carpool lane.
And what are the federal standards?
The standard is that the carpool lane needs to be moving at least 45 miles per hour, 90% of the time.
Nope.
It's not happening.
No, it's not.
Not happening all the time. And because we're talking about, I mean, these are federal interstate highways, mm-hmm. so the government could hold back funding if we don't keep the carpool lanes moving fast enough. Mm-hmm. So that got lawmakers in California to want to do something to speed up the lanes.
But are clean air vehicles really the problem? Because I see a lot of people in the carpool lane who are just cheaters. They drive alone. They don't even have a sticker. I mean,
yeah, these sneaky solo drivers. That is the mm-hmm. elephant in the room in this conversation. Mm-hmm. In the Bay Area, about 1 in 4 drivers in the carpool lane are cheating, mm-hmm. according to a state study. And that's actually way more. There's way more cheaters in the carpool lane than people with clean air vehicle stickers, about 3 times as many.
So instead of taking away people's stickers, why not just crack down on people from cheating in the carpool lane instead?
Yeah, I mean, if you could eliminate the cars that are using that lane illegally, that would make a much bigger difference than phasing out a portion of the electric cars. Mm-hmm. And if you ask local transportation officials, they'll say, yeah, we want better enforcement. We want more police patrolling the carpool lanes. But it's kind of not up to them because the highways are patrolled by the state. And when lawmakers were working out the rules for these new stickers, the Bay Area's transportation planners asked them to put in more money for cracking down on toll lane violations. Mm-hmm. But in the end, nothing about enforcement made it into the final bill.
So for people thinking about buying electric cars right now, how long is this red sticker going to last? How long can I drive in the carpool lane?
The red sticker right now is only good until 2022.
That's 3 years.
Yeah, so maybe that would get renewed, but you couldn't necessarily rely on it. There have been a lot of changes to the rules for the stickers ever since the program got started. And mm-hmm. now that electric cars have gotten cheaper, the state might decide finally that people don't need the carpool lane incentive to buy electric cars. In a way, this program is a victim of its own success, right? People are buying so many electric cars that they're filling up the carpool lanes.
Yeah, but it's not just the electric cars. It's also them cheaters.
Yes. Yeah. The problem is all of us. It's not just that we have too many electric cars or even too many cheaters. We have too many drivers mm-hmm. right now in the Bay Area, more than our roads can support. We're packing in more and more people, and it's slowing down traffic everywhere, not just in the carpool lane.
Okay. Thank you, Eli.
Thanks, Anand.
Eli Wirtschafter is KLW's transportation reporter. We'll link to more information about the new sticker rules at our website, kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Actress Nilaja Sun has returned to the Berkeley Repertory Theater with the West Coast debut of her one-woman show, Pike Street. Theater fans may remember her 2008 sold-out run of No Child. In Pike Street, she takes us back to 2012 during Hurricane Sandy. The storm was one of the costliest in U.S. history, causing $70 billion in damages across 24 states on the East Coast. Nilaja invites audiences into the living room of a Puerto Rican family preparing for Sandy in New York City's Lower East Side while facing the storms in their own personal lives. From a war veteran battling PTSD to a bedridden child with a brain disease, Nilaja transforms into all of them. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with the Obie Award-winning actress backstage at the Berkeley Rep.
Pike Street is the borderline between Chinatown and the Lower East Side. And so so we have so much going on in the Lower East Side, so many languages, so much food. And at the same time, we're all okay with one another.
And did you grow up on Pike Street?
I grew up on a street called Montgomery Street, which is about 4 blocks away from Pike Street. So I grew up super close to Chinatown, 2 blocks away from the East River. If it gets to be too bad, the East River can flood that part of the area, and that's what happened during Hurricane Sandy. More than anything, it wasn't just the flooding, it was the fact that many of the residents there didn't have running water and electricity for many weeks, and so it was one of those neighborhoods that was completely forgotten. I wanted to write a play so that when if and when that ever happened, we would remember to help the elderly, help the people who are disabled, who are some elderly in the Lower East Side are living on a 20th floor. And what are they going to do if another big hurricane comes around?
Were you in New York when Hurricane Sandy hit?
I was in New Jersey, so my folks live in Jersey now. We it was just a mess because we have our Atlantic Ocean, and we had a lot of floods. So I was in my folks just making sure that my parents' basement didn't flood, and so I would help my pop out with anything he needed. I'm an only child, so.
Me too.
Yay! So if there are any natural disasters, I'm up in my parents making sure everyone is okay, because, you know, I the older I get, the more I'm looking out.
Tell us about the Vega family.
Yeah, so the Vega family are Puerto Rican. They live in the Lower East Side, and this is the kind of play where you got to be open in order to, you know, just go on this ride with me. And Berkeley, y'all are okay to go on a ride, and I love that.
And it is a ride, and like I said, you just have so many people, and so many people that often don't have a voice. You gave a voice to someone who's almost, you know, she's debilitated. She can't talk. She can't use the bathroom on her own. She's bedridden, Candy. Mm-hmm. What inspired that character?
When I was growing up, my grandmother lived with us, and she was actually Doña Lola Vasquez Vega, who finds her way in Pike Street, and she was in a wheelchair. She was the strongest woman I know. However, when folks who didn't know her saw her, I could see that they kind of treated her like she was feeble, and it was at a very young age that I realized that you can have a very strong spirit, and yet at the same time, people perceive you as being weak or vulnerable. And so one of the reasons why I wanted to show Candy and demonstrate who Candy is that she, like my grandmother, was so strong before the brain aneurysm, is so strong still now. And what happens when this hurricane happens and there is this kind of wanting to protect her when we can't necessarily protect ourselves. So that's why she finds her way in Pike Street.
Yeah, because she brings balance and calm to people even though she can't speak.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Evelyn, her mother, is all about vibrations because she is really interested in this new age, kind of African, very esoteric spirituality. So everyone who comes into Candy's energy with any kind of negativity, Evelyn really quickly wants to squash any kind of negativity. And but we find out that there's only so much she can protect from Candy, you know.
What about Manny? Mm-hmm. I had a lot of sympathy for Manny.
Yeah. So Manny is a decorated Navy SEAL. He is someone who, when he walks out into the street, kids know him because he is known in the Lower East Side for being a hero. And but at the same time, he was shot in the head in Afghanistan. So he's trying his best to be, in a way, like the man of the house, but he's still dealing with, in a sense, mental illness, depending on what environmental triggers are happening at the time. And so you can imagine if there's a hurricane in this loud city, there are things that sound similar to war.
And his storm, too, is regret, too, as well.
Absolutely, regret and loss of love.
And then there's Poppy, who is a character. He's a character. That's a character.
Yeah, he is, absolutely. You know, the VA, you know, that's where a lot of the veterans go to shoot the stuff and just gossip. And, you know, so he's one of those guys who's just being the absolute most, you know, and doing his rumba and his salsa, and he drinks a little bit, you know, a little bit too much and smokes a little. Well, it's legal here in California. He'd be happy here. But he loves to live.
Yes, and he's sexually active and very proud of it.
Yes, exactly. He is a true Puerto Rican man.
He's a senior, you know.
He's a senior. It doesn't end. It does not end, absolutely. And why should it?
So you said you wrote this play. so many characters, so many, from the family to the homie down the street. You know, you have the ancestors.
At the corner store.
Muhammad at the corner store. Yeah. The ancestors are in the, I mean, you're playing all these people. What was the writing process for you like?
I tell my students, especially those who are very physical, that the writing process actually happens on the train, in the shower, walking down the street, rather than just sitting and writing. Because if you really want to embody these characters, they have to initially be embodied in your body first.
I mean, you had a conversation with the son and the daughter and the father and an ancestor. I mean, and it's just boom, 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 boom. I mean, and I'm seeing these characters. Like, I don't even see you on the stage. I have this image of how these people look. And the fact that you were able to talk so quickly and keep up with that pace and that beat that we have sometimes as we communicate as people of color was amazing.
They have to be people that I really deeply love, really deeply am very passionate about, because if the play is a success, like my last play, No Child, I performed that play over 1,000 times. So I better love this play. I better love these people. I better be so in love with them. I am 100% in my characters at all times.
That was Nilaja Sun speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. Nilaja's one-woman show, Pike Street, is running now at the Berkeley Rep through Sunday. Find information at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Across the bay, on the south side of San Francisco, another performance is taking place. This one is an annual tradition in a transformed arena off Geneva Street. In a space once reserved for livestock and cowboys, the streets of Victorian England come alive. It's the Great Dickens Christmas Fair. In this story from our archives, Nina Gensler-Debs takes us there.
I should think to recoup a little of our story before we begin here.
I'm sitting with a group of a couple dozen people pressed in around a table to hear Charles Dickens tell us the tale of his classic, A Christmas Carol. This is the second of three readings he'll give today.
Let us recall that Ebenezer Scrooge has come home from his counting house to encounter the phantom of his old dead partner, Jacob Marley. Dead 7 years ago this very night.
If it wasn't for the crowds wandering just beyond the door or the occasional flash of a camera, it's almost possible to imagine that you are in fact sitting in Victorian-era London on a snowy day. And that is exactly where the Dickens Christmas Fair wants to take you.
Here we come, a waltzing among the leaves so green. Here we come, a wandering so fair.
The fair takes up 3 acres of the exhibition halls of the Cow Palace. It's roughly divided into 2 larger sections. One part is a more well-heeled London. Think top hats and brocaded gowns.
And the Honorable Mr. Snob, as always.
Good day, sir, good day, and a happy Christmas to you.
The other half is the seedier East London. That's where you'll find Cockney accents and generous displays of cleavage.
They're the builder's sewer, no less. Oh, it's true, it's a shame.
Within both areas, there are almost 100 vendors, 5 pubs, 7 stages, and lots of elaborate sets. There's hay sprinkled on the floor, it smells like sugared almonds, and the lighting is soft. It's supposed to feel like twilight on Christmas Eve.
We bring in over 14 semi-truckloads full of materials and building and decorations to build the physical aspect of the fair.
That's Kevin Patterson, the executive director of the Dickens Christmas Fair. He tells me that producing this fair is, quote, in his blood. His parents started by producing a Renaissance fair here in 1967.
And when my parents were doing the Renaissance fair, they were also doing a lot of themed parties.
To make a long story short, Kevin's parents hosted a Victorian-themed party that all the guests loved, and who said, you should make this as a fair. So they did. And in 1970, the Dickens Christmas Fair was born. Kevin and his wife took over producing it in 2000.
So there are 3 generations of people here who have been working since they worked with my parents in the 1960s, developing their crafts and developing their acting skills.
And there is a sense of a garden where the older trees and so on have been there for a long time, and things grow around them and they know how to bloom and all of that.
That's Robert Young. You heard him earlier performing as Charles Dickens. He's been involved with the fair since 1986 and became Dickens in 1990.
Phyllis Patterson, Kevin's mother, one of the original producers, buttonholed, as they say, buttonholed me during a rehearsal and said, "You ought to play Mr. Dickens." I'm like, "Really?" She said, "Oh, yes, yes, yes." And that began it.
He's been Charles Dickens ever since. Robert is one of 800 actors, volunteers, and independent outside groups working here, playing characters who sing, dance, eat, drink, and interact with fairgoers and each other. All of them go through the same rigorous training program, a 3-weekend-long series of workshops to learn how to be as authentic as possible.
We request that everybody do a language workshop, to do a social history workshop, and to do an acting workshop, generally improv or deep character work, that sort of thing, to really get the blood stirring and get you going with your character work. So there's a fair amount of training.
The best of the holidays, Merry Christmas to you this day, and may your new year be filled with fortune in every way.
That's Father Christmas. He's another longtime actor, and like Kevin Patterson's parents, he also raised his child at the Dickens Fair. And now that child, Shannon Domnovitz, is the marketing director for the fair.
I have vague memories of being very small and essentially running wild throughout the bays and feeling absolute freedom.
You could say that Shannon's life was shaped by her involvement with the fair. She met, grew up with, and then married another participant. Now they have 2 kids who work there every year. She says that there have been some unforeseen consequences from raising your kids at a Victorian fair.
The teachers and the principal wanted to speak to me about my daughter and the fact that she was telling tall tales. She had told her other classmates that her grandfather was Father Christmas.
And sometimes it can be tough for non-fair people to really get it.
They can only equate it with a community theater or an amusement park, the thing that we're all investing our lives and our families in. So it's difficult to know when you can break with reality and when you can't.
But for the most part, people who play parts in the fair seem to happily and wholly abandon the reality of 2016 for this world.
I am Matthias Kupriason, inventor extraordinaire, and Arms Dealer International.
So I'm Jack, and I'm a able seaman before the mast on Her Majesty's ship Albion.
As you might be able to guess, those are assumed identities. When I ask these men what their real names are, each of them looks a little puzzled and, frankly, a little dismayed to be taken out of their characters. Matthias Kupriason, a.k.a. Matt Friedman, is one of the visitors to the fair that chooses to show up in full steampunk attire, including a waistcoat, top hat, and mad scientist goggles. He's here with a big group of other steampunks, and he wishes that more people took the time to dress up.
The crowds and everybody who doesn't like to actually try to get into the period kind of destroys the immersion a bit.
And Able Seaman Jack, a.k.a. John Carlson, is so committed to his character, he doesn't drop the English accent for our entire conversation and refers to the fair as London.
I've been going to London since the 1980s, I think. What I find so wonderful about this is that it is such an uplifting and such a wonderful, warm and gracious event.
And with his line of work, John tells me he needs warm and uplifting moments.
In my mundane life, I'm a firefighter. I've been doing that for over 35 years. And we see a great deal of the tragedy and the trauma in humanity. And so for me to come here, it gives me a little relief and a little joy.
Here we come, a wassailing among the leaves of green.
A little joy. That is what the Dickens Christmas Fair aims to deliver to all of its visitors. And to quote Scrooge himself, I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. In Victorian London, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs for Cross Currents.
We are not daily beggars that beg from door to door, but we are neighbors' children whom you have seen before. Love and joy come to you, and to you your wassail too, and God bless you and send you a happy new year, and God send you a happy new year.
That story originally aired in 2016, but the fair is actively taking place weekends right now through December 23rd. Help yourself to more details at kalw.org. And if you don't want to miss events like these, subscribe to the Cross Currents Weekly newsletter. Just follow the link under the Cross Currents tab at our website, and you know what it is, kalw.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Angela Johnston, Sarah Nora Coast, Kristen McCandless, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, Porfirio Rangel, Josh Wilson, and Lisa Wang. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tarek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Hadil. Our managing editor is David Boyer, and our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
If the squad ain't with me, then it ain't right.
This music is by rapper P-Lo from Pinole. He'll perform at the UC Theater Taub Family Music Hall tomorrow to celebrate first-generation artists and the Filipino Bay Area influence in his music. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baban.
Big bag plays on FaceTime. Squad ain't with me, then it ain't right. Same squad, same squad, same squad. Drop top, coupe, dodge, range drives. Big bag plays on FaceTime. Squad ain't with me, then it ain't right. Same squad, same squad, same squad. Cross move quick like AI. Chain shine bright like